Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Lots of things I'd love to take care of. Hey, last week, somebody called me, speaking of trees, and asked about a tree that is... every fall when it happens, everybody says, ooh, what is that? I want that tree. It's a very interesting tree, and they can't find the name of it because it's not in, it doesn't grow much north of Alabama. And so they have all kind of crazy names, and then they go out and try to buy the tree that they think it is, and it doesn't turn out to be the right tree. Let me give you a name for this thing, and let me describe the tree first. It looks like it's hung with little bitty fuchsia colored pinkish pastel lavender colored little paper lanterns. it's just weird all over the tree, and it's very striking, kind of orangish, really weird colors on these little papery little husks that are very ornamental this time of year. It's called there's several names. It probably most commonly called Chinese flame tree. I've also seen it called Chinese lantern tree, and I think that's a good name. It's better than flame tree, because flame tree is kind of confusing, because a lot of trees are called flame tree. I like Chinese lantern tree because it's pretty descriptive. It works pretty well, though not a lot of people call it that. So if you look it up, you might not get the right tree. But Chinese lantern tree is growing, and I would say if we had to stick with a name, I wish we would stick with that one. It is not the rain tree. So a lot of people call it rain tree, but that's a very different tree. It's related, but it's very different. Performs very differently here. So it's not that tree, and it's not a. It's not the Japanese scholar tree, and it's not the Japanese umbrella tree, and a bunch of others. It's not any of those. It is this Chinese flame tree, Chinese lantern tree. And so somebody asked me last week, how do you propagate it? They were having a hard time propagating it. And I said, gosh, I don't know, because the one problem with this tree is that it produces so many seedlings. And so when you plant it in your yard, you get weedy seedlings coming up everywhere. So just be prepared for that. We don't think it's that invasive yet. We haven't seen anything that it is invasive outside your yard. But in your yard, it might drive you crazy because of all the seedlings. And it's just like it's got hundreds of seeds, and they all germinate. But it's a beautiful tree. So there's a warning. But somebody said they were having a hard time propagating it from seed, and I'm not sure why. And I said I would look it up to see if... But really, no. I mean, just take it out. Take the seeds out of the husk. You don't plant the husk. Take that paper thing away. Just plant the two or, you know, I think there's usually a couple of seeds in each husk. Plant those seeds in there, and really within a week or two, most of those seeds germinate. So... give it another shot. I don't know why we would have problems, particularly with this tree. Now, if it were a rain tree, if it were a true rain tree, which I don't think people are going to see down here because it doesn't grow that well down here, it might need some cold. But so there it is, just a follow-up to something that happened last week with these Chinese rain trees. We're going to talk a little bit more about trees and what trees work well here and what don't. If you've got questions, you give us a call. Hey, John, what's up?
Yes, sir. I had a couple of quick questions for you. I wondered, what's the best kind of musky dime to plant in this area? Huh?
I didn't hear that very well. Say it one more time.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could tell me what's the best kind of musky dime to plant in this area.
Oh, okay. Well, boy, any kind of musky dime. I can't think of one that won't work. It really is about flavor and which flavors you like. There are a lot of cultivars out there. I You know, do you like bronze? Triumph is one that comes to mind in terms of a bronze. It's a beautiful bronze muscadine. The one muscadine I will have to say, and I'm just going to say this out loud, the one muscadine that I think does not do as well here is Scuppernong. Now, this is very confusing because people think Scuppernong is a different kind of fruit. It isn't. It's just it's the name of a particular kind of cultivar of muscadine that has small bronze fruits. Right now, we've got a lot of bronze muscadines that are much better than Scuppernong. But, you know, Fry is great. Fry is a beautiful dark purple. They're all very good, and they all perform well. So, except for Scuppernong, that's really the only one that I know that I think doesn't do as well. Here's where people have problems with muscadines, and two things to think about. The first is what you train it on, because really, it can make such a mass and such a tangle that it quits fruiting very well. So muscadines on an arbor, as I've discovered, and I was determined to try it on an arbor myself in some modified way, is really very difficult to handle. And it's not long before you run out of muscadines. It quits producing because it gets to be such a tangle. So you want to grow the muscadine in some way so that it's easy to prune, very easy to prune. And once you plant, we talk about pruning. Once you get the hang of it, it's very easy to do. But it needs pretty big pruning every year if you're going to keep it productive. So really, what you really want to plant it on is a two-wire fence. Or a three-wire fence, but a two-wire fence is probably best. And rather than trying to do it overhead, because it's very difficult to handle once it gets overhead. There are probably some ways to do it overhead, but it's going to make it a lot trickier. So put it on a fence. That's really important. And the second problem I have with muscadines, and I'm not sure I figured this one out, are raccoons. And I mean, competing with animals for muscadines when muscadines are at their peak is something. It can be tough. But, maybe a good feist dog would be the thing to do. Feist dog, as we would call them in Mississippi and West Alabama. Feisty little dog, like a rat terrier or something, might help if you could keep them outside at night when the raccoons are going to be raiding the muscadines. Right. But other than that, almost all muscadine varieties are going to do very well here. Does that help?
It does. But would the botanical gardens have it? And if so, when is that sale?
Yeah, that sale is next week. And let me see. I have got a list of most of the plants. Oh, I can't get to it now. But here's what I'll do. If I will look at that list and see if muscadines are on the list. They usually are. They usually are. And that's a great way to do it. There are some places on the internet that sell muscadines. And I'll have to look at some of those places on the internet. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to check the list first to see what kind of muscadines may be available to botanical gardens. Muscadines are also something that you'll often see at our locally owned nurseries. So I would certainly try to go to our locally owned nurseries, and check to see if they happen to have, these plants. A Bloom. Certainly I would check with A Bloom in West Mobile to see, I would check with Old Time, in Fairhope to see if they have these varieties. Okay. But I will, before the hour is out, I will check out the list of plants at the botanical gardens, and I'll let you know. Okay.
Great. And I got one other question for you.
Yes, sir.
1 minute.
I'm looking to put some ground cover in shady areas, you know, and in planter areas around trees and stuff. Can you suggest a good ground cover for shady areas?
Yes, I can. I love it. And so here's the one of the best ground covers, because you can walk on it, which is really nice, and you can mow it. And it can be kept neat, and it almost looks like grass is monkey grass. And liriope is great. Go ahead and plant it in these shady areas. It's really perfect. People give away monkey grass all the time because it does spread, and slowly, and it'll spread. And sprig that monkey grass in. It is one of the best ground covers I know of for shady areas. It'll do very well in those areas. And eventually, once it gets well established, you can mow it. That's the really neat part. I hope that helped. We're going to be back. We're going to take a break. I got to be quiet so Taxman could listen to this. He's going to want to hear it.
Cornbread and butter beans, and you cross the table eating beans and making love as long as I am able. Growing corn and cotton too, and when the
welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast sunny morning with Plain Gardening. We talked about muscadines, and there are muscadines at Mobile Botanical Gardens. One of those muscadines they're selling is scuppernong, so I did a really bad job of selling that one. It's not one of my favorites for this area. I know that a lot of people will buy it just because of the name. But a scuppernong is just a kind of muscadine. It is a cultivar that was found, oh gosh, I think in Delaware, some place crazy, way up the Atlantic coast, and it doesn't do as well down here as some of the other varieties. It's an old one, but it's not a good one, not for us. They have Carlos, and they have Southern Home, which is a good black, and Southland. I'll have to look them up. I think Carlos is a little bit is a drier muscadine. Really, I think it was developed to produce wines. Probably a little, maybe the sugars are a little less intense than some of the other bronze, but it's a good one. Southern Home and Southland are both good. They're good blacks. Purple. My dad used to call those purple muscadines, they'd call them, bullets. which is confusing because that's an old name for plum. But there it is. Big black purple muscadines. Southern Home and Southland, very good. You want to check to see which ones are self-fruitful, or if they're not self-fruitful, you may need two varieties. I'm going to check on that before the hour is out. We're going to figure that one out. We've got some other questions. Rusty, I got to get to Rusty real quick, because Rusty asked me a question earlier in the show, and I haven't answered it. Rusty, can we talk about that now?
Yes, Bill. My buddy was looking at putting one of these in. I never heard of it.
Yeah, so it's high-rise live oak, right?
I believe that's what it is.
Yeah, here's what it is. It is a live oak that has been selected carefully so that it has, the genetics were selected so that it has a strong central leader. It doesn't spread out like the live oaks that are typical. It doesn't spread out nearly as much. And when live oaks, and it's very interesting, because if you go in the woods, if you go into a place where there are natural live oaks, and one of those places, for example, is over there at Orange Beach, at the place they call the Maritime Forest. If they haven't mucked it up too much, they put in a lot of trails and other things. I don't know what survived. One of the problems with natural areas is that they turn into recreation areas, and sometimes you don't get to see the forest anymore. But at Orange Beach, right where some of those bike trails are, you'll see some live oaks, and they have no lower limbs. They're just, they grow straight up just like a white oak, and you might think they're just a regular old white oak, but that's the way these live oaks tended to grow naturally in a lot of areas. We've tended to create live oaks and selected for live oaks that put their limbs way, way, way out because we think that's neat. The trouble with those is that the limbs shear off very easily, even without wind. So you have to be very careful about pruning them, or you have to let the limbs touch the ground to support themselves, and we do neither. They developed a live oak called High Rise to solve this problem. It's more like those live oaks that I've seen in the woods that don't have those lower limbs. It tends to grow straight up like a white oak without those big spreading limbs. And so it can be much better in a hurricane. The question is it better than having a white oak? I don't know. That's an interesting question. But it's probably going to do much better in hurricanes than we haven't been growing them that long, but they're probably going to do better in a hurricane and better and it'd be have much less chance of limb shearing off, even during non-hurricane days, which is what we're seeing a lot of now. So there's the advantage of the high-rise live oak. I would say swamp chestnut oak, which is a type of white oak, would do just about as well. But you can certainly, I'm interested in hearing about the high-rise live oak, and in about 50 years, we're going to know really well how good they are. Does that help, Rusty?
He picked that. It's actually for a very good location. And I was just wondering about the shearing, the wind shearing, because he's on the water like I am. And I saw what his house went through after Katrina. So I was just curious about that.
Yeah, well, it's going to be better. There's no question it's going to be better. I would not plant a really big oak. If I were in a wind vulnerable area, I would not plant a big oak within 25 to 50 feet of my house. If the winds were really severe, and I would back them off so that they don't fall on my house. Any oak, I'm going to worry about that. Any large, really large oak. Because if you get a storm surge, which you can on the waterfront, it will dig live oaks out of the ground. That's what happened at Long Beach. The storm surge with the waves will actually dig those live oaks out of the ground. And, you know, it'll dig your house out of the ground too. But it's, nothing's going to survive the storm surge. But wind, you know, these may be a little better at surviving the wind. They're going to be much better at avoiding the problems that occur with live oaks, even on calm days where those limbs just shear off. So that's good. Closer to the house, I would plant things like palms and small trees. You know, you got a small tree that doesn't get more than, say, 30 feet tall and doesn't develop really heavy limbs. There are lots of them. They're not going to do a lot of damage if the limbs break off. And so that's kind of nice. Does that help, Rusty?
That is perfect, Bill. That means he actually picked out the right tree.
Yeah, right. That sounds good.
Thank you very much, Bill.
All right, thank you. Always good to hear from you. Tara, I'm listening. What's up? Tara, you there? Well, maybe we lost.
I was just thinking about your most recent comment with this gentleman. The hickories were the first to fall, as far as my experience, okay? I can barely hear you. Are we okay?
Yeah, we're good. I'm just listening to you. Which storm was that, Tara? Was that Frederick?
Well, pick one. There was George's and Katrina. Okay. So we're talking a long time. Yeah. I am a super survivor so far.
Let me talk a little bit about hickories.
It's been a very anxious week for me, and I have the most compassion and sympathy for those folks that I know what they're dealing with in Mexico Beach and the surrounding areas.
Yeah. So let me talk a little bit about hickories, which are beautiful trees, and I love hickories.
Me too.
And but let me I'm going to talk about hickories. It's very important. They are very sensitive to root disturbance. And if you build a house that's too close to a hickory, or if you build a sidewalk, or if you put in a water line and it's within 25 feet of that hickory, you can damage the roots, and they just don't appreciate that. So when you plant a hickory, plant it in a place where you're not going to be doing a lot of groundwork around it, or it will go over. Now, what I do find is that hickories are actually, they're not in the highest category of wind resistance, but they do okay. They're probably middle range, maybe lower middle range in how trees perform generally in terms of wind resistance, because the wood can be a little bit brittle. But generally, I think they survive pretty well as long as the roots aren't damaged. Now, that might be a challenge in most yards, but just be thinking about that. Root damage can be a big issue if you're not careful. And so that's where hickories are a problem. Any other observations?
Yes, sir. I have reports on experiments. A property where there is wetlands on one side, wide river on another side, and a canal on the other side, long and rectangular. My choice, having been a survivor of these sorts of things, was to go ahead and let what was distributed from the amazing pine trees, all different kinds, in this area, and let them go ahead and seed and grow up. And then I was going to thin them out, but I talked with a brother of mine who studied forestry, and he said, no, just leave them alone for a while. They'll thin themselves out. Meanwhile, break it down and let it become part of the elevation which was needed in that particular area. And it's been successful so far. Not only that, but when the piers were breaking off of everybody else's property and floating into my property, it did exactly what I was hoping it would do. Even the ones that I trimmed, and I only cut them down to 3 to 4 feet, knee high or whatever, because for one thing, you don't want them cut down so short that you're going to step on them with the composting that's going on. When people say, well, look, there's that pier here and there's that pier there, especially the insurance agents people, and I go, well, you know what? If that pier wasn't there, it would have been here whamming my house apart.
Yeah. So that's interesting. So you're using the trees as a barrier for the storm surge, for the debris brought in from the storm surge, and that is very interesting. I think
this is my experience, Bill. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think the first layer is going to be sacrificial. Of course, in some cases, it might float over a 4 foot high stem. So, if we get a big surge, it might float over some
larger trees. These were only the ones that were closer to the house that I threw
right
back.
I see. So the ones that
do the barrier work.
Yeah, and so, well, that's interesting. And so I think having a thick growth near the water is probably a good thing. Some of those trees are going to be sacrificial because they're going to get debris is going to get piled up against them, and
that hasn't happened, interestingly enough.
Yeah.
Not really. Because this is river. This is not, bay or a gulf. So yeah, that's a whole different bunch of stuff, but. Can I
Tara, it looks like we got to take a break. We're going to be back. Give us a call, 251-343-0106.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Well, lots of things to think about this morning. We had talked about pine trees last week, and Tony, I'm interested to hear how your pine tree situation's going. One of the problems with hurricanes is that they do damage to trees that's hidden, and you don't see it. So there'll be cracks in the trees and other things that allow insects to invade. So a lot of trees that are damaged by hurricanes may not actually die or show any signs of damage until much later. And we'll talk about that too. Loblollies are going to be really prone, and maybe even slash pines now, to damage from pine bark beetle. Some of the longleaf may get Ips beetles as a result of being racked, but you know, the good thing about that kind of situation is you just have to watch out for it, but at least the trees aren't going to fall on your house. So just something to think about. Tara, you had a few more thoughts. I'm sorry, we had to take a break, but what you had another question. She gone. Okay, good. Buck, I'm listening. What's up?
Hey, good morning. Enjoy your show there, Bill.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, I got two real pretty live oak trees in my front yard.
Yes, sir.
And I've got grass all over my front yard, but right around those two trees, I don't have any grass. It looks like the dirt is on the edge of the limbs, I guess, what you'd call it. And I can't get no grass to grow. What can I do, or I just don't have to do what
yes.
I need to do?
So it's really tough. It's really going to be tough under live oak. I mean, live oaks and grass don't go together until the live oaks get to be very old. And I would say sometime around sometime between 75 and 125 years, the live oak will open up enough that you'll actually get enough sunlight there for the grasses. So there's your problem. They actually are casting so much shade that the grass can't grow. Grass needs lots of sunlight, and there's no substitute.
Yeah, I planted some sod there a little while back, and it all died.
It all died because it's just not getting enough sunlight. It's also having to compete with the tree roots, which extend well out beyond the limbs. But if it's ending at the limbs, then I would say the biggest problem is lack of sunlight. There are some things you can do, but they'd have to be done very judiciously. One of the things that you can do is to get an arborist in, somebody who really knows what they're doing, and thin that tree out so that a little more light falls on the ground. And there are a number of ways of doing that, but that could help. But, you know, it's still going to be hard no matter what with a live oak. And so what I would suggest is thinking about ground covers that do well in shade. We talked about one earlier in the show. What is my favorite? Because it's so easy and because you can walk on it. And that's monkey grass. I think monkey grass does very well there. You can actually eventually, if you let it get established, and you can actually mow it. Just like it's a regular grass, and it can be very good. I love monkey grass for situations like that, and it's fairly easy to get from your neighbors. It's hard to buy at a store in the kind of volumes you need, but neighbors are always putting, just separate the pieces and plant them out, sprig them around, and treat them nice, water them in real good, give them a little mulch to grow in if you like, and they'll begin to take that area over very nicely. So that's one way to do it.
Little lime and fertilizer wouldn't do no good.
No, sir. Because here's the thing. Let me just make clear. What do plants eat? We have been told by people who manufacture fertilizers that plants eat fertilizer. They do not eat fertilizer. Fertilizer is just a grease. It's like a little bit of a minor little bit of a... It's kind of like a vitamin that they eat. But what plants manufacture their own food, and they do that by photosynthesis. So plant, no matter how much fertilizer you give a plant that's in shade, it won't make any difference because there's not enough sun to make the machinery work that produces the food for the plant. So fertilizer's useless in shade. And in fact...
Okay, if I put something around it, like that monkey grass, it wouldn't hurt as far as the rain and everything still. It wouldn't trap the rain from going down in the ground, would it?
No, in fact, it'll help. It'll help to make sure that more of the rain gets infiltrated. Monkey grass. Yeah, it'll make sure that the monkey grass means that more of the rain will go into the grass and there will be less runoff.
Okay.
So you're going to be great with the monkey grass. The bare ground is going to absorb less moisture than almost anything else. So, it would be better if you had just a pile of dead leaves there. It would absorb more moisture than bare ground. So,
well, let me ask you one more thing, Bill. What about this red bark you can buy at Lowe's or something like that? Would you advise that or advise not to advise it? To put around
that's a lot of red bark, and it's going to look kind of funky, but you could certainly do it. I don't think it's going to, it kind of looks like barbecued chicken wings out under your, you know what I'm saying?
If you don't mind the look. Let me ask you one more question.
Yeah.
Are y'all going to have y'all's a sale at the gardens?
That's right.
Y'all ain't done had it, have you?
No, it's next weekend. Next weekend, and thank you for asking. Next weekend. October 19th, yes, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So there'll be lots of plants out there for sale.
I appreciate it. We'll see you out there, okay?
All right, great. Thank you so much. Any more callers, Charlie? Is that that catch us up? So, there are other ground covers, and a lot of people have been using Asiatic jasmine, the trouble with Asiatic jasmine is it's like, and I know people do it because they just give up, and Asiatic jasmine seems to grow just about anywhere, and it does, but you can't walk in it. It's like that's forever off the, it's off the table. It's just like a no man's land forever. And, I happen to think it's more likely to harbor cockroaches and other things than if that bothers you. And it's also allelopathic. It actually, for some reason, and what I mean by that is it damages other plants that grow in it. So I don't recommend Asiatic jasmine for situations like that. I know it's popular now. I think monkey grass is much safer and much easier, and it's great to walk on. And you can even roll around in it. You can even wrestle your brother in it, which is really great. That is sort of my prerequisite for grass, is that you have to be able to wrestle your brother in it, or for a ground cover. I don't want to wrestle my brother in a mess of Asiatic jasmine. I don't want to sit with my children in a mess of Asiatic jasmine. But monkey grass, you can mow it. It's perfectly good to sit on, just like a regular grass. That's one of the reasons why. I think about that. So Dan is asking me, what's the difference between Asiatic and Confederate jasmine? Well, there's a big difference, and it's a good question. Confederate jasmine is going to bloom. That's basically it. They're different species, maybe even different, maybe the same genus. But the Asiatic jasmine will never bloom. It's just there, and it's not a shrub. It doesn't have the qualities of a beautiful shrub that flowers. Confederate jasmine at least blooms, and it does. It is very fragrant. Now, sometimes Confederate jasmine drives me crazy because it just eats everything, too. It tends to grow over things. It's not native, even though it has the name Confederate. The name Confederate comes from Malaysia, and seems to refer to the Malaysian Confederacy, which it's sort of like Confederate Rose, what we call Confederate Rose. It's not, has nothing to do with the Southern Confederacy. It has to do with Asia. These are Asian plants that we've brought over here, and because it had the name Confederate, I guess it helped to make it popular in the South for whatever reason. But these are not native plants. They can grow very aggressively. Confederate jasmine at least has flowers and blooms and has a great fragrance, or a strong fragrance at any rate. So Asiatic jasmine does not. They're two very different species. So there it is. There's the difference between them, and something to think about as you're doing this. You know, it is interesting to think about and very important to talk about that plants, all plants, you've heard me say this, but I can't say it enough. All plants need sunshine. Some plants can get by with less, but they still need sunshine. And sunshine is how they feed themselves. They don't feed themselves with fertilizer. So if you don't have sunshine and the plant needs a lot of sunlight, and virtually every lawn grass we have, St. Augustine, Bermuda grass, Zoysia grass, they all need lots of sunshine. They need sunshine more than most plants. So if you put them under a live oak, they just aren't going to survive there. Now, if the live oak grows in slowly and the grass is already there, sometimes they'll survive for a while after that oak is there. But they got to have sunlight, and there's not anything you can do, not watering, not fertilizer, not lime. None of those things help if the machinery of the plant feeding itself, which is photosynthesis, can't operate because there's no sunlight. So, just by the way. There you go. Oh, I love this song. Hey, we're going to listen to this, and we're going to be back. Got about 10 minutes before the hour's up. Give us a call, 251-343-0106.
My old hand is a good old hand. She lays eggs for the railroad man. Sometimes one, sometimes ten. That's enough for the railroad man. Look, old hen, pluck and sing. You ain't laid an egg since away last spring. Look, old hen, pluck and squall. You ain't laid an egg since away last fall.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Lots of little questions here we need to answer. Tony in Fowl River sent me a picture. He has trimmed up his live oaks a little bit to get a little more light into them. And it seems to have helped him, he says. I would be careful about pruning live oaks because of the danger of the limbs shearing off. You want to have a professional arborist do it. They can really do it well, but it can make a difference in how much light gets there. And then he sends me a picture of a weed that is very typical of what we see under live oaks. It's basket grass, Tony. Actually, there's several weeds there, but I think the dominant one is what I would call basket grass, Opilus manus. You don't care if I say that word, but basket grass is what it is. It's actually used as an ornamental in some places and as a ground cover in Florida, and it makes a pretty good ground cover. It doesn't survive the winter, but it makes a pretty good ground cover in shady areas, and it's an okay thing. But when you see Opilus manus, when you see that basket grass, you know that that's there because there's too much shade. It is one of those plants that takes over in an area where there's too much shade for regular grass to grow, and that's why that's happening there. If you got rid of it, it's not likely that the grass would come back because that's a pretty good indicator that there's too much shade. So there it is. Can monkey grass be used near the house? Yeah, sure, absolutely, absolutely. There's no reason monkey grass can't be used next to the house. Will the dogs lay in it without digging? I have a dog, but I'm not an expert. I can't... The psychology of dogs is unpredictable, is it not, David P? Is there anything that dogs that are prone to digging, is there anything that they won't dig in? No, I think there's nothing they won't dig in. What I will say is that monkey grass will stand up to dog traffic much better than a lot of other grasses will. So much better than St. Augustine. So it will do that. I don't know that it will... and I think dogs would like to lay in monkey grass. They would like it very much. Will it attract rodents or snakes? No, not any more than any other plant. And no, I don't know that plants attract rodents and snakes so much. I mean, what rodents are after are certainly is well, you know, trash. So it's not, I don't think it will attract rodents or snakes, just to answer those questions which came up. So what other questions have we got that I haven't answered? I think I've gotten to most of them. It's really good if you've got a plant, if you've got an area with a lot of shade. I think that it can be really difficult to get grass, conventional lawn grasses, to grow there, and it's good to think about other things. And there is a number of ways of approaching that. Monkey grass, if you want something to walk on, is one of the easier things to do. For those of you who are worried about snakes, I'd love to talk about snakes and what kind of snakes you're worried about and why they may or may not be a problem. We can talk about that. I think we're probably going to run out of time to do all of that today. Hey, let's go back over some of the things that we've talked about today, because they're very important. It's fall. For me, the official start of this thing that we call fall, because we don't have another name for it, I would rather call fall full. It should be, the season should be named full, not fall. Because it's full of things. It's full of flowers. It's full of produce. It's full of vegetables. It's full of color. It's full of light. The days are just full of this crystal light. The fish, the specks, the speckled trout. Greg, you tell me if I'm lying. The specks, the speckled trout, all of these other fish are moving up into the Delta. The white shrimp are moving in and out of the Delta now. It is the season of fullness here along the Gulf Coast. It is just this incredible season of abundance. You know, we think of fall as the time when birds leave to go other places. What a crazy idea. What an insane idea. If you're in Detroit, yes, but you're not in Detroit. You're in Mobile. The birds are coming here. It is our season of fullness. We've been living with mockingbirds all summer long, and suddenly you hear all of these bird calls that you haven't heard for months, because the birds are arriving. They're coming in huge numbers. You know, the ground is just full of things like hickory nuts. It is the season of plenty. It's the season of abundance. It is the season of great beauty, this thing called fall. It's starting here October 15th. And it goes on right up until mid December, and leaves will be gradually slowly turning colors all during that time. But there'll be all kind of great flowers. There are plants in my yard that are just beginning to flower now. They love the season of the year. I've got 2 months of great blooms. What a great time! To go to the Mobile Botanical Gardens. They've got a great sale going on right now. It's going to be starting next week, just in time for fall, the best time for planting. The Mobile Botanical Gardens starting Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Hey, folks, don't miss that. It's a really great sale. It's a really important time. Charlie, you said, I have a question. Have we got time for... Yeah, I'm listening. What's up?
Yeah, I wanted to know who was the Yahoo that renamed the goldenrod from the state of Alabama some frilly, loosey name of the flower.
Yeah, so who renamed goldenrod? Well, of course, the state flower is now the camellia.
And why did they do it?
Well, I can tell you why they did it, because the camellia was the symbol of the Klan and a lot of neo-Confederate groups. And so at the same time we were putting the flag in, and camellias were getting very popular, we were putting the Confederate flag back up. We also decided we would make the camellia the state flower. And I love camellias, and I think they're really great, but there were a lot of politics involved in that. So kind of complicated, really weird. Goldenrod was also supposed to be responsible for hay fever. whether it was or not, in fact, it is not responsible for hay fever. It's just completely not, and it was a mistaken idea. And goldenrod seemed native and natural, and we apparently don't like native and natural things here. We wanted something exotic to be our state flower. But there were a lot of weird politics. It happened in the 50s. It was all changed over in the 50s. Interesting question. You should have asked me when I had more time to talk about that one. We'll be back. Give us a call next week.